Most people, all these demands can't freeze you up. Years ago, one of my most productive staff members, Cheryl, came to see me. She looked exhausted. After we chatted, I learned that she felt totally overloaded by a massive list of responsibilities. I asked her to list all of her tasks and projects. Then I went through them with her, and I prioritized them. The effect was immediate. It was as if a giant weight had been removed from her. I can still picture the look of relief on her face when she realized that she could focus on what mattered most and let the other things wait. When small demands are given too much attention, big problems arise. Often the little things in life trip us up. A tragic example is the accident that occurred on Eastern Airlines Flight 401 on the evening of December 29, 1971. The plane, carrying 163 passengers and 13 crew members out of New York, experienced a problem as it approached its destination in Miami. The light that indicates proper deployment of the landing gear failed to light. The pilot put the plane into a holding pattern. While members of the flight crew tried to find out whether the landing gear was deployed, the plane flew in a large looping circle over the swamps of the Everglades while the cockpit crew checked to see if the gear actually had not deployed or if instead the bulb in the signal light was defective. After some work, they removed the light bulb, but they still weren't sure the landing gear was down. The pilot set the second officer down to the avionic bay beneath the flight deck to try to ascertain whether the front wheel was down. While the three experienced flight crew members were trying to chase down the problem, they lost track of something much more important, their altitude. And while circling on autopilot, the plane had gradually lost altitude. 10 seconds after they noticed the problem, the plane flew right into the Everglades. Sadly, more than 100 people died, and in the end, investigators discovered that the only problem was actually a faulty light bulb. Robert J. McCain is said to have observed, "The reason most major goals are not achieved is that we spend our time doing second things first, or third things, or fourth. Anytime small demands or insignificant tasks displace important tasks, we can get into trouble." Making everything a priority means nothing is a priority. A family that had become fed up with the noise and traffic of the city saved their money and finally realized their dream. They sold their cramped apartment, bought a ranch, and moved out west. Their desire was to move to the country to enjoy life in the wide open spaces and raise cattle. Some friends from the city came out to visit them a month later and asked how they were doing and what they had named their ranch. Well, the new rancher said, "I wanted to call it the Flying W, but my wife said she wanted to call it the Susie Q. Our eldest thought the name should be Bar J, and our youngest hoped that we would name it Lazy Y. So we compromised, and we're calling it the Flying Lazy Y W Bar J Susie Q Ranch." "Wow," said a friend. "Can I see your cattle?" "Oh, we don't have any," the rancher said. "None of them survived the branding." Okay, I'll admit that that's really a corny story. But I love it because it illustrates the fact that when you say everything is a high priority, then nothing is a high priority. It really indicates that you're unwilling or unable to make a decision, which means you won't get anything done. Sometimes it takes an emergency to force people to prioritize. For some people, only a crisis can cause them to rethink their priorities. That was the case on the night of April 14, 1912, when the great ocean liner Titanic crashed into an iceberg in the Atlantic. One of the most curious stories to come from the disaster was of a woman who had a place in one of the lifeboats. At the last second, she asked if she could return to her stateroom for something. She was told that she had only 3 minutes. As she hurried through the corridor, she stepped over money, other valuables that had been dropped in haste. And once to her stateroom, she ignored her own jewelry and instead grabbed 3 oranges. Then she quickly returned to her place in the boat. Hours earlier, she wouldn't have exchanged her least valuable piece of jewelry for a boxcar full of oranges. But circumstances had changed her priorities, and they can for many of us. Priority principles. Someone once said, an infant is born with a clenched fist, an adult dies with an open hand. Life has a way of prying free of the things we think are so important. If you want to develop the leader within you, don't wait for tragedy to realign your priorities. Become proactive about the process starting today. Begin by acknowledging the following principles. Number one, working smarter has a higher return than working harder. Novelist Franz Kafka said productivity is being able to do things that you were never able to do before. How do you make that happen? Doing the exact same things with greater intensity rarely works. As Albert Einstein allegedly pointed out, the problem of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. So how do you get better results? You have to rethink how you do something. You have to work smarter. That means finding better ways to work and making the most of the moments that you do have. Marketing expert Dan Kennedy says, disciplined use of the time everybody else wastes can give you the edge. What leader doesn't want that? Principle number two, you can't have it all. When my son Joel was a young child, every time we entered a store, I would have to tell him, you can't have it all, Joel. Like many people, he had a hard time narrowing his want list. But I believe that 95% of achieving anything is knowing what you want. That's especially important for someone who is leading others. Years ago, I read a story about a group of people who were preparing for an ascent to the top of Mount Blanc in the French Alps. The evening before the climb, their French guide explained the main prerequisite for success. He said, to reach the top, you must carry only what's necessary for climbing. You must leave behind all else. It's a very difficult climb. A young Englishman disregarded the expert's advice, and the next morning he showed up with a bunch of items in addition to his equipment. A brightly colored blanket, large pieces of cheese, a bottle of wine, a couple of cameras with several lenses, and several bars of chocolate. You'll never make it with all that, said the guide. You could only take the bare necessities to make the climb. But the Englishman was young and strong-willed, and he set off on his own in front of the group to prove that he could do it. On the way up to the summit of Mont Blanc, the rest of the group, carrying only the necessities under the guide's direction, began to notice items along their path. First, there was a brightly colored blanket, then a bottle of wine, and some pieces of cheese, camera equipment, and finally chocolate bars. When they reached the top, there was the Englishman. Wisely, he had jettisoned everything unnecessary along the way and had made the summit. Many years ago, I read a poem by William H. Henson that communicates a great lesson about priorities. He who seeks one thing and but one may hope to achieve it before life is done. But he who seeks all things wherever he goes must reap whatever around him, whatever he sows, a harvest of barren regret. If you want to be successful as a person and as a leader, you must make choices. You must prioritize. You cannot have it all. No one can. Principle number three, the good is always the enemy of the best. Most people can prioritize between the good and the bad or between right and wrong. The real challenge arises when we are faced with two good choices. Which should they choose? An excellent illustration of this can be found in the parable of a lighthouse keeper who worked on a rocky stretch of coastline before the days of electricity. Once a month, he received a supply of oil to keep the light burning. Not being far from town, he often had visitors, and one night an old woman from the village begged for some oil to keep her family warm. He had pity on her and gave her the oil. Another time, a father came and asked for some oil for his lamp so that he could search for his missing son. Another person needed some oil to keep machinery going so that he and his employees could keep working. Each request was good, and each time the lighthouse keeper gave them oil for their worthy cause. Toward the end of the month, he noticed the supply of oil was very low. By the last night of the month, it was gone, and the beacon went out. That night in a storm, a ship wrecked on the rocks, and lives were lost. When the authorities investigated, The man was very repentant, but there was only one reply. You were given oil for one purpose, to keep the light burning. As you become more successful and busier, you must learn to navigate the choice between two good things. You can't always have both. How do you choose? Remember that the good must sometimes be sacrificed for the best. Principle number four, proactive beats reactive. Every person is either an initiator or reactor when it comes to planning. In my opinion, you can choose or you can lose. Proactive means choosing. Reactive means losing. The question isn't, will I have things to do, but will I do things that make a difference? To be an effective leader, you need to be proactive. Take a look at the difference between initiators and reactors. Initiators prepare, plan ahead, pick up the phone and make contact, anticipate problems, seize the moment, put their priorities in their calendars, and invest time in people. In contrast, reactors repair, live in the moment, wait for the phone to ring, react to problems, wait for the right moment, put other requests in their calendar, and spend time with people. If you have any doubt about the impact of initiating versus reacting on your productivity, just think about the week before you go on vacation. It's probably the most productive and efficient time at work. Why? Because you have to clear priorities and hard deadlines. Before leaving the office for vacation, we need to make decisions, finish projects, clean off the desk, return calls, and close the loop with colleagues. Why can't we always run our lives that way? Actually, we can. But it requires a change in mindset. Instead of focusing on efficiency, which is a survival mindset, we need to think about effectiveness, which is a success mindset. Instead of focusing on doing things right, we need to focus on doing only the right things. We need to become fervently and continually proactive. Principle number five, the important needs to take precedence over the urgent. The more responsibility you carry as a leader, the more you have on your plate. The ability to juggle multiple high-priority projects successfully is something every successful leader must learn how to do. As the list of tasks grows, you can agonize or organize. I'd rather organize. Here's a simple but effective way to classify tasks that can help you quickly prioritize them in any given moment. The goal is to determine how important the task is and how urgent it is. Ineffective leaders jump on the urgent task without thinking. Effective leaders weigh both factors for each task and act accordingly. Here's how. High importance, high urgency. Tackle these tasks first. High importance, low urgency. Set deadlines for completion and fit these tasks into your daily routine. Low importance, high urgency? Find quick, efficient ways to get these tasks done with minimal personal involvement and time. If possible, delegate them. Low importance, low urgency? If these tasks can be eliminated, then get rid of them. If they can be delegated, then find someone to do them. If you must do them, then schedule a one-hour block every week and chip away at them, but never schedule them during your prime time. It doesn't take much time or effort to review your to-do list every morning and evaluate each task using the importance urgency criteria. And it's an effective way to help you prioritize and put your things into order quickly and plan your day. Having a strategy for evaluating your daily to-do list by priority is invaluable. After all, a life of which anything goes will ultimately be a life in which nothing goes well. But if you have no solutions for determining priorities other than that, you will still be too reactive instead of proactive as a leader. So I want to give you some tools that will help you with priorities in the bigger picture. Proactive priority solution. Number one, the Pareto Principle. A veteran of many years of decision-making gave me this simple and direct advice. Decide what to do and do it. Decide what not to do and don't do it. I love that. But the evaluation of priorities often isn't that simple. Many times, knowing what to do is not black or white, but many shades of gray. Many years ago, while I was taking a business course, I was introduced to the Pareto Principle, named for Italian economist Vilfredo Pareto. It is commonly called the 80-20 Principle. I quickly saw the value of the concept and began applying it to my life. 45 years later, I still find it a most useful tool for determining priorities for myself, for anyone I coach, and for any organization. The Pareto Principle, when applied to business, says 20% of your priorities will give you 80% of your production if you spend your time, energy, money, and personnel on the top 20% of your priorities. Here are some examples of how the Pareto Principle plays out in life. Some of these are humorous, but all of them are true. For example, time. 20% of our time produces 80% of our results. Counseling. 20% of the people take up 80% of our time. Products. 20% of the products bring in 80% of the profits. Books. 20% of the book contains 80% of the content. Now, just a moment before I go on. That excludes, obviously, my books. Let's go on. Jobs. 20% of our work gives us 80% of the satisfaction. Speeches. 20% of the presentation creates 80% of the impact. Donors. 20% of the donors give 80% of the money. Taxes. 20% of the people pay 80% of the taxes. Leadership. 20% of the people make 80% of the decision. Oh, and yes, picnics. 20% of the people will eat 80% of the food. Look at just any situation and you'll find that the 80-20 rule applies. Why? I don't know. But it just does. As a leader, you need to understand this principle because it comes into play in everything you do as a leader. I've included in the PDF referenced at the beginning of this audiobook a graph that dictates out what this looks like visually. The solid lines in the illustration represent your two top priorities. Spending time, energy, money, staff, and so forth on those two items would result in a fourfold return in productivity. However, the remaining eight items will give a minimal return. The implications are clear. Since the top 20% of your items on your to-do list give you an 80% return, you should focus on them. The top 20% of your staff should give you the 80% of your return. Focus your time and energy on them. The top 20% of your clients give you 80% of your return. Focus on them. The top 20% of your offers produce 80% of your return. Focus on selling them. The place this principle impacts leaders most is in the people they lead. Employees do not impact organizations equally. The top 20% carry the greatest load and make the greatest difference. Unfortunately, the people who require the most time and attention are often those in the bottom 20%. In contrast, the people at the top often demand the least from their leaders because they are motivated and self-directed. But who should be taking time to invest in? But who should you be taking time to invest in? The top 20%. Here's how to apply the Pareto Principle to the people on your team. Determine which people are the top 20% when it comes to production. Spend 80% of your people time with those top 20%. Spend 80% of your personal developed dollars on those top 20%. Help the top 20% to determine what their top 20% return is, and allow them to give 80% of their time to it. And allow them to delegate the other 80% of their tasks to others to free them up for what they do best. Ask the top 20% to do on-the-job training for the next 20%. How do you identify the top 20% of your team and your organization or department? I have provided a worksheet at the end of the chapter to help you do that. I strongly suggest that you just take the time to use it because it's critical that you invest in your top 20%. If there are five people on your team, your number one person is your top 20%. If 10, then the first and second are on that list. If 20, then the top four. You got the idea. Your top 20% are the people you should be investing in, giving resources to, and providing with leadership opportunities. They will make or break the team. Another proactive priority solution is the three R's. If you are from my generation, you remember teachers talking about the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic. I know two of the three R's don't even start with R. I want to offer you a different three R's to help you become highly proactive in identifying living out your priorities. To do that, you have to look at your life from a bigger picture perspective. Think of it as a 30,000-foot perspective. The three R's are requirement, return, reward. See, they actually start with R. You can discover your major priorities by asking yourself three questions based on these three R's. Number one, what is required of me? Every role has responsibilities that are non-negotiable. There are things you must do that you cannot delegate to anyone else. Do you know what they are? When I became the leader of Skyline Church in San Diego, I asked the board who was hiring me, what must I do that only I could do and I cannot delegate to anyone else? We talked it through in a couple of hours, and they decided there were only a few things that only I could do, such as being the primary communicator most Sundays, carrying the vision of the church, and maintaining my personal integrity. These were my non-negotiables and could be fulfilled by no one but me. In the end, a leader can give up anything except final responsibility. If you work for a boss or a board, they can help you answer the requirement question. If you work for yourself or you own your own business, the question may be more difficult to answer. But it's critical. Otherwise, you'll end up focusing on the wrong things, which could waste your time, talent, energy. The second R, what gives me the greatest return? What are you good at? I mean, really good at. This is at the heart of the return question. What brings the greatest return on your investment of time and energy for your organization? That's a question I continually ask myself. I understand that activity is not accomplishment. Productivity is. I'm at my most productive using my best talents, gifts, and experience doing three things: communicating, writing, and leading. Those give the greatest return to me and to my organizations. They are my sweet spot. Anything else I do is second rate, or worse. Knowing what activities give you the greatest return is vital. What do people continually compliment you on doing? What tasks or responsibilities do colleagues continually ask you to take on? What do you do that makes the biggest positive impact or brings in the most revenue? These are clues to help you answer the return question. The third R, what is most rewarding? Life is too short not to be fun. Our best work is accomplished when we enjoy it. It gives us great internal rewards, which can be mental, emotional, or spiritual. And here's the standard I often teach to help people answer the reward question. Find something you like to do so much that you would gladly do it for nothing. Then learn to do it so well that people are happy to pay you for it. Here's a clue for knowing what's most rewarding. When you do something and you think to yourself, I was born to do this, you're on the right track. Your long-term career goal should be to align the tasks that answer your requirement, your return, and your reward questions. If what you must do, what you do well, and what you enjoy doing are all the same things, then your career priorities are in sync, and you will live a productive and fulfilling life. Now, it takes time and hard work to bring those things together. At the end of this chapter, I will have provided a roadmap to help you evaluate how you're currently doing with your three R's so that you can start working to get them into alignment. Proactive priority solution number 3, make room for margin. For years, I practiced the discipline of spending a few hours during the last week of the month planning out my schedule as far as the upcoming month is going to be. I would literally schedule my priorities and requirements into hourly time blocks day by day, and I used to pride myself on how I valued and prioritized my time. I had mistakenly convinced myself that if I could keep to the schedule and work fast and long enough, I would get to a place where I caught up on everything, and that would create margin in my life. After years of this fruitless exercise, I discovered that I was deceiving myself. I realized that Parkinson's law is true. Work expands so that it fills the time available for its completion. Unless I did something intentional to create margin, I would never have it in my life. Physician and author Richard Swenson has written extensively on the idea of margin. In his book, Margin, Restoring Emotional, Physical, Financial, and Time Reserves to Overloaded Lives, he wrote, "Margin is the space that exists between our load and our limits. It is the amount allowed between that which is needed. It is something held in reserve for contingencies or unanticipated situations. Margin is the gap between rest and exhaustion, the space between breathing freely and suffocating. Margin is the opposite of overload. Instead of filling every space in my calendar, what I needed to do was create some white space. If I didn't, no one else was going to. People who keep burning the candle at both ends aren't as bright as they think they are. I needed to change by creating margin in my life. In the 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership, I wrote about the law of priorities, which says, leaders understand that activity is not necessarily accomplishment. Even though I wrote about that law, I must confess that living it has been a continued challenge for me for more than 20 years. Creating margin is not easy for a person who loves to work and thrives on deadlines and continually feels the press of making things happen. But I also recognize that the greater the responsibilities you have as a leader, the more responsible you are to create margin in your life. By no means do I follow through with this perfectly, but I do work persistently to create margin in my life. If you desire to be a leader who lives according to your priorities and reach your potential, then you need to learn how to create margin too, and here's why. Number 1, margin improves self-awareness and emotional intelligence. Emotional intelligence is the ability to recognize and understand emotions in yourself and others, and to apply this awareness so that you manage your behavior and your relationships with others. There are a few abilities more important than EQ when it comes to leadership. The training and consulting organization TalentSmart has tested more than 1 million people for EQ and found out that 90% of the top performers rate high in emotional intelligence. One of the fantastic things about EQ is that, like leadership, it can be developed. A foundational characteristic of emotional intelligence is self-awareness. A strong recognition and understanding of your own emotions can be developed during times of reflection, often when you're alone. Those windows of time don't come if you're overloaded and never have time for self-reflection. Margin creates such times, which provides you with the opportunity to grow in your EQ. Number 2, margin gives you needed time to think. Most leaders I've met have a strong bias for action. I know that's true with me. But if I spend all my time acting and never thinking about what I'm doing, I won't be a very effective leader. When I lead others, it's my responsibility to try to see more and before others see. I have to think more and before the people that I'm leading. Truett Cathy, the founder of Chick-fil-A, told me, "We need to be thought leaders before we can be market doers." Creating margin lets us do that. It is true that we are today where our thoughts have brought us, and we will go tomorrow where our thoughts take us. That's why I'm dedicated to reflective thinking and having written about it in so many of my books. If you want to become a good thinker, you need to create white space in your calendar for it, not just settle for a minute here and a few seconds there. You need to schedule significant blocks of time for it. If you're constantly running from one to-do appointment to the next, from sunup to sundown, you'll never become a better thinker. Number 3. Margin provides you with energy renewal. We live in a culture of busyness, and leaders are often the busiest people of all. Founder and CEO of the Energy Project, Tony Schwartz, has studied and written extensively on energy and performance. He wrote in a New York Times article, "More and more of us find ourselves unable to juggle overwhelming demands and maintain a seemingly unsustainable pace." His solution? Paradoxically, he said, the best way to get more done may be to spend more time doing less. A new and growing body of multidisciplinary research shows that strategic renewal, including daytime workouts, short afternoon naps, longer sleep hours, more time away from the office, and longer, more frequent vacations, boost productivity, job performance, and, of course, health. All of the things Schwartz described as beneficial require margin. And he said that human beings are designed not to expend high energy continuously, but to alternate between spending energy and recovering energy. So if you want to be at your best, you need to find ways to recharge. You can do that by creating space for relationships, exercise, recreation, travel, music, and so on. Whatever recharges your personal batteries is good, but you need to find margin for it. How to create margin? As I've said, creating margin is a challenge for me, but I keep fighting for it because I know it helps me live out my priorities and be a better leader. Here are two things I do that I believe can help you. Evaluate and eliminate continually. I'm constantly on the lookout for ways to simplify my life. I try not to spend time on things that are out of my sweet spot. I delegate or dump anything that doesn't fit into the 3 R's, and I use the 80-20 principle whenever possible to downsize. And you can too. Start by asking yourself some of the following questions. What are the 20% of my possessions that I get the most value out of? What are the 20% of the clothes I wear 80% of the time? What do I spend 20% of my leisure time doing that gives me 80% of my happiness? Who are the 20% of the people I'm close to that make me feel happiest? Chances are you answered all these questions fairly easily. You've just never considered looking at these areas in the way that you have before. Focus on the areas where you gained the most. In the remainder, create margin. Give away clothes or possessions. Reduce the complexity of your life. Fight to keep 20% of your calendar as white space. My days of automatically filling up my calendar with tasks are done. Instead, I schedule white space into my calendar. With a nod to Pareto, my target is always to leave 20% of my time free. I would suggest that you fight for that same percentage. What might that look like? You could choose to create margin every day. If you spend, on average, 16 hours a day awake, creating margins means leaving 3 hours and 12 minutes unscheduled every day. If you wanted to think in terms of your week, you would need to leave out about 22 and a half hours unscheduled every week. Margin by the month. Leave 6 days totally open. By the year, 72 unscheduled days. You may be saying to yourself, I can't do that. I can't spare 3 hours a day or 6 days a month. And I'm definitely not taking more than 70 days off, I think the same way. That's why margin is so difficult to maintain. Tony Schwartz agrees. Taking more time off is counterintuitive for most of us. The idea is also at odds with the prevailing work ethic in most companies where downtime is typically viewed as time wasted. More than one-third of employees, for example, eat lunch at their desk on a regular basis. More than 50% assume they'll work during their vacations. Yet to create margin, taking essential time off is exactly what we need to do. You can't maintain your priorities if you fill your life with busyness. If you're a high-energy doer, you may find it difficult to stop. Take stock of your activities. Think through your priorities and reevaluate what you do and how you do it. But you need to do it, not just once, but day after day, year after year. Priorities never stay put. Yet if you can learn to master the principles of priorities and you develop the discipline of applying them continually, you will find your personal and professional effectiveness will be off the charts. Few things give a leader as great a return as good priorities. That's why I say they are the key to leadership. Developing the prioritizer within you. The need to get a handle on priorities can feel overwhelming, especially in our culture where priorities never stay put. Busyness is expected, and being overloaded is applauded. For that reason, you may want to do this chapter's application in stages. Embrace priority principles. Begin by determining the areas where you've not lived according to good priorities. Think about how you can change your everyday work habits. Answer the following 5 questions based on the priority principles in the chapter. Number 1, where do I need to work smarter instead of harder? Number 2, what must I change to stop trying to have it all? Number 3, what good things can I stop doing in order to do the best? Number 4, what must I do to become more proactive instead of reactive? And number 5, what can I do to stop doing urgent but unimportant things? Pareto Principle Workshop. The Pareto Principle can be applied to almost any area of your personal or professional life. For leaders, the most critical application comes in your investment in people. You need to identify the top 20% of your people that you lead. I've included in the PDF referenced at the beginning of this audiobook a template for you to use as a worksheet. Also included is the 3 R's worksheet. This allows you to organize responsibilities or requirements and evaluate them based on return and reward. Margin call. Examine your calendar. How much white space does it contain? If it contains less than 20%, you need to begin doing some cutting. If you don't use a calendar of any kind, then start using one today. You have a different kind of problem with priorities. Use the work you've already done in this chapter as your guide concerning what to cut and what to keep. Chapter 3, The Foundation of Leadership, Character. On October 12, 2016, I had the privilege of meeting Pope Francis and spending a few minutes with him. I have admired him for many years. His humility and character have made a strong impression on me. Traditionally, when a cardinal is newly elected as pope, when asked if he will accept his election, he responds, "Accepto," meaning, "I accept." Francis' first words were instead, "I am a great sinner, but I trust in the infinite mercy and patience of our Lord Jesus Christ, and I accept in the spirit of penance." This man has led the way toward championing character formation within the leadership of the church, and his heart for transformation stirred me to ask him to pray for the John Maxwell Foundation, the nonprofit organization I founded, to become a catalyst for positive transformation in countries such as Guatemala and Paraguay. I was humbled when he said yes. Character in leadership. In the lead-up to my meeting with the pontiff, I read a lot about him. One of the articles I came across was by Gary Hamel, a management consultant and founder of Strategos, in the Harvard Business Review. Hamel wrote about a meeting Pope Francis had with a group of church leaders in which he outlined the problems inherent in leadership. He called them diseases. There were 15 of them, and most of them dealt with character. Number 1, thinking we are immortal, immune, or downright indispensable, which is the enemy of humility and service. Number two, excessive busyness, which leads to stress and agitation. Number three, mental and emotional petrification, which creates heartlessness. Number four, excessive planning and functionalism, which leads to inflexibility. Number five, poor coordination, which fosters independence and lack of cooperation. Number six, leadership Alzheimer's disease, where leaders forget who nurtured and mentored them. Number seven, rivalry and vainglory, where titles and perks become leaders' primary focus. Number eight, existential schizophrenia, where leaders live hypocritical double lives. Number nine, gossiping, grumbling, and backbiting, where cowardly leaders speak ill of others behind their backs. Number ten, idolizing superiors, where leaders honor superiors to gain favor and get ahead. Number 11, indifference to others, where leaders think only of themselves. Number 12, downcast faces, where leaders treat their inferiors with sour severity. Number 13, hoarding, which involves accumulating material goods to seek security. Number 14, closed circles, where leaders place their clique ahead of shared identity and cooperation. Number 15, extravagance and self-exhibition, where leaders seek greater power and recognition. I found this list quite insightful. It's clear that Pope Francis has dealt with all kinds of leaders during a long career of service. And the list prompted me to examine my own character. Am I a healthy leader? I wondered. I read a list of questions included in the article that were designed to help with self-examination process, which asked, To what extent do I feel superior to those who work for me? For what extent do I demonstrate an imbalance between work and other areas of my life? To what extent do I substitute formality with true human intimacy? When do I rely too much on plans and not enough on intuition and improvisation? When do I spend too little time breaking silos and building bridges? When do I fail regularly to acknowledge the debt I owe to my mentors and to others? When do I take too much satisfaction in my perks and privileges? Or when do I isolate myself from customers and first-level employees? Do I denigrate the motives of others and their accomplishments? Do I exhibit or encourage undue deference and civility? Have I put my own success ahead of the success of others, or have I failed to cultivate a fun and joy-filled work environment? When do I exhibit selfishness when it comes to sharing rewards and praise, or encourage parochialism rather than community, or behave in ways that seem egocentric to those around me? Questions like these heighten my awareness of the need to keep improving my character, especially in the context of leadership, because the heightened influence of leaders magnifies their impact on others, both positively and negatively. The reality is that leading ourselves is often the most difficult task we face every day. It's much easier to tell others what to do than to do it ourselves. I know that's true of me. To keep myself on track, I must continually remind myself why character is so important. Since I'm a person of faith, I've discovered wisdom from Scripture related to character. I found the following list in David Kadaly's Leadership Resource Kit. If you don't connect with these thoughts or are offended by them, please feel free to skip past them. Our hearts can be deceptive. Jeremiah 17:9, Psalm 139. We can so easily seek leadership office for the wrong reason. Matthew 20:17-28. Character is the area that will face the greatest attack. Romans 7, Galatians 5:16-24. Character is foundational to Christian leadership. 1 Timothy 3:1-13, Titus 1:6-9. Without it, we struggle with the temptations that come with skill, talents, and gifting. Romans 12:3-8. It is so easy to slip into a life of hypocrisy and forget that we will have to give an account one day. Hebrews 4:13. We naturally neglect this part and focus on other developments. 1 Timothy 4:7 through 8. We discover that strength of character is what will count in hard times. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Working on my character is a never-ending yet totally worthwhile effort. Mahatma Gandhi said, "A man of character will make himself worthy of any position that he is given. I want to be a worthy leader, yet I know I sometimes fall short. I want to improve my character and encourage you to improve yours, not because it gets me what I want, but because it helps me to be what I want. And I find that the more I focus on valuing people, practicing self-leadership, and embracing good values, the stronger my character becomes." Character value statements. Having good character does not ensure that you will be successful in life or leadership, but you can be sure that having poor character will eventually derail you personally and professionally. But here's the good news. If your character is not what you want it to be, you can change it. It doesn't matter what has happened in your past. You can choose a better path moving forward, starting today. As one of my favorite sayings goes, "Though you cannot go back and make a brand new start, my friend, anyone can start from now, make a brand new end." Here are three great reasons why good character is worth pursuing. Number one, good character builds strong trust. Recently, I asked a small group of executives to list the names of the top three people they trusted. Family and friends were on everyone's list. Amazingly, no one named a leader or co-worker as one of their top trusted people. I then asked them to list three people of whom their well-being and happiness depended. Everyone named either their boss or a co-worker. Then I asked them one more question. If I were doing this exercise with your subordinates, and I asked them to create their most trusted list, would they name you as one of the three most trusted people? There was a murmur. That got their attention. What difference might it make if you were someone they put on that list? The consensus was that if people trusted their co-workers and leaders, the working environment would be more positive and people would be more productive and turnover would be reduced. That's consistent with my own observation that people quit people, not companies. The greatest cause of turnover in organizations is lack of trust. Stephen M. R. Covey, in his book, The Speed of Trust, pointed out how low trust costs time and money, and he used a fantastic example to illustrate it. After the 9/11 terrorist attack, the nation's trust in flight security went down. Covey said that before the attacks, he could arrive at his home airport 30 minutes before his flight and have no problem making it quickly through security. However, after the TSA tightened security, he had to arrive a couple of hours ahead of domestic flight departures and sometimes 3 hours ahead of international flights. As trust went down, he said, speed also went down and the cost went up. Too often we talk about trust as if it is a singular thing. It's not. Trust is a relationship between a trustor and trustee. Just as it takes two to tango, it takes two to trust. The role of the trustor is to take the risk of trusting, and the role of the trustee is to be trustworthy. And when both people do their parts well, the result is a trusting relationship. And trust doesn't go in one direction. The people exchange roles, the trustee becoming the trustor, and vice versa. It is a two-way street. But if either party fails in his or her responsibility, trust disappears. Again, as Kouzes and Posner explain the importance of the development of trust in leaders. In the final analysis, only you can decide whether to take the risk of trusting others and whether the risks are worth taking. This means to have others trust you, you must actively take some initiative and can't wait for others to make the first move. As many leaders explain, trust is a risk game. Leaders must be the first to ante up. Leaders always find the ante worth risking. Sowing seeds of trust with people creates the fields of collaboration necessary to get extraordinary things done in organizations. For years, I have taught leaders that in their interactions with others, they create accounts of trustworthiness. Every interaction with another person either makes deposits in that person's account or makes withdrawals from it. The best way to make regular ongoing deposits is by modeling good character consistently. Why? Because people are convinced more by what a leader does than by what a leader says. I find myself agreeing with the idea expressed by industrialist and philanthropist Andrew Carnegie, who said, "As I grow older, I pay less attention to what men say, and I just watch what they do." Words can be cheap. Journal's Arthur Gordon was right when he said, "Nothing is easier than saying words. Nothing is harder than living them day after day. What you promise today must be renewed and redecided tomorrow, and each day that stretches out before you." That's why in leadership, a pint of example equals a gallon of advice. In the beginning of a relationship, words hold more weight than actions. Because people do not know you, they may assume that your words represent who you are and that your walk matches your talk. However, as the relationship continues, your actions begin to weigh more than your words. People do what people see. Leadership confusion occurs when your words and your walk do not match. If that incongruity continues, not only will you confuse your people, you will lose your people. Mark Twain was right when he said, "To do right is wonderful, to teach others to do right is even more wonderful and much easier." Easier? Yes. More effective? No. At the opposite end of the spectrum from inconsistency and broken trust is moral authority. This is the highest level of leadership. It is earned by demonstrating consistently good character and continually making deposits into trustworthiness accounts with others. Charisma may get leaders a following early on, but only credibility prompts people to continue to follow them. When leaders possess true moral authority, the only words they need to say are, "Follow me," and the people join them. They know that their walk matches their talk and is headed in the right direction. Can we all gain moral authority as leaders? Maybe not. But we should strive to do our best to develop and display good character so that we at least are candidates to develop it. I have to confess, my view on character and moral authority has changed over the years. I used to see trust as black or white. Now that I'm older, I've grown, and I think I have greater insight into how trust works and how character comes into play with it. I'd like to share with you some of the changes I've had in my thinking. See if you agree with them. Maybe you will. Maybe you won't. That's okay. Another good thing about getting older is that I'm very comfortable with people not always agreeing with me. I thought trust was nice to have. Early in my leadership journey, I didn't recognize the importance of trust. I thought it was nice to have. Who doesn't want to be trusted, given the choice? But now I understand that in leadership, trust is essential. It's not something you can take or leave. If you leave trust, you're going to leave leadership. Trust dramatically impacts real leadership issues, such as follower engagement, connection, buy-in, and effectiveness. Trust is the foundation of leadership. A strong foundation isn't a luxury. It's not just nice to have. It's critical. I also thought that trust was up to them. Some leaders, especially who rely on their position or their title to lead, instead of their influence, take the posture that they should be implicitly trusted by the people, but that their people must prove themselves to be trustworthy. They put all the burden for developing trust on others, not themselves. But developing trust is a leadership responsibility. If I want to be a good leader, it's not up to my followers. It's up to me. I must take the first step in trusting the people I lead, and I must take steps to earn their trust. Good leaders take the risk in both directions. If my people learn to trust me, I'll get their attention. But if I initiate trust in my people, I'll get their action. And the essence of successful leadership is getting things done. I used to also think that trust could only grow slowly. While it's true that trust often does grow slowly, it doesn't always have to work that way. For example, when individuals you trust vouch for someone they trust, you're likely to give this person that you've just met the benefit of doubt and trust in him or her. Why? Because of the relationship you have with your trusting friend. You transfer your trust, at least until you discover reasons of your own to withdraw that trust. Another instance where trust can be earned quickly comes when someone performs an unselfish act of significance for another person. I experienced this as a young leader, when another leader stuck up for me at a very crucial time. His endorsement of me in a meeting gained me favor with others. I was grateful because I had done nothing to earn it, and he could gain nothing for himself by giving it. He immediately gained my trust. Here's an encouraging thought. We can be the person who does something selfless for others and helps them along their way. Doing this makes the world a better place, and if we do it for the people we lead and help them become more successful with no ulterior motives, we can develop a relationship of trust rapidly. I used to also think that a single mistake automatically destroyed trust. While it's true that a single mistake can destroy trust, that is not always the case. When the trust level is already low, then that's often all it takes. However, if the trust level is high, one mistake seldom destroys what people have built in the relationship. If you're as old as I am, you remember the days of President Nixon and Watergate. Immediately after the scandal broke, the trust level was very low toward leaders in the United States. At that time, I remember hearing Billy Graham, whom I greatly respect, say, "Everybody has a little bit of Watergate in them." That was level setting. It brought a dose of reality to everyone's idealism regarding leaders. If someone like Billy Graham has a little bit of Watergate in him, then so do I, and so do you. Always doing right, regardless of the situation, goes against our nature. But we can fight to do what's right most of the time. And we can know that as long as we keep adding deposits to our trustworthiness accounts with others, we have a chance to withstand the mistakes that we do make. Knowing this allows me to forgive my humanness as a leader, and it helps me be more committed to extending grace to other leaders when they make mistakes in their humanness. I have a much longer view of character now than I did years ago. I recognize that character development is a lifelong process. In his book, Build Your Reputation, networking expert Rob Brown describes this ongoing process. In the world of work and busyness, your go-to status won't happen overnight. It won't even happen by chance. You're building a platform here, a house, if you like, brick by brick, comment by comment, conversation by conversation. Even if you could build it fast, how sturdy would it be? You don't want to be a one-hit wonder. Any fool can get hired or booked once. The best, most sought-after thought leaders and prime promotional candidates didn't start out yesterday. It's a slog. It means some heavy lifting. It's going to take a long time, and it's going to be worth it. It's going to take a little time. And it's going to be so worth it. But be under no illusions. Building a great reputation requires a consistent, focused effort. Tortoise and the hare. Slow and steady wins the race. Marathon, not a sprint. And all that. With a few spurts here and a few spurts there. So much of leadership relies on good character. Trust is created through it. Talent is protected by it. Internal peace is fostered by it. People cannot climb beyond the limitations of their character. Leaders cannot succeed beyond the depth of their character. Good leaders have the potential to be difference makers, and character makes a difference for them and protects them. Good leaders are often a gift to the world. Character protects that gift. Number two, successful leaders embrace the four dimensions of character. In his book, Derailed, Tim Irwin wrote that there are four dimensions to character: authenticity, self-management, humility, and courage. I agree with his perspective, and I want to use those four dimensions as my framework for describing the process of character building.